Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. It's a great delight to be here at Abhayagiri, especially here to be present for the Katina ceremony time, but more particularly just to be back in the home territory. This monastery was opened up about 18 years ago, and the development since that time is very, very wonderful to see. I left about 4 years, just over 4 years ago, and it's very heartening to see that life carries on here in much the same way as when I was around, and also just the steady development of the community, and getting acquainted with the new faces, the Sangha living here, and also new people visiting, and a few new amenities around the place. So it's very delightful to see that kind of ongoing quality of faith and commitment and energy going into the place and seeing it all develop. I was walking over the large lump of concrete out front yesterday, and the foundations for the community facility, the meditation hall and kitchen and so on, that will be there, the reception hall. And remembering how even before we even moved onto the property, I believe, going to the county offices, I think with Debbie and maybe even Fred was there, talking with the planning department and showing them this little piece of paper with a sketch of what buildings we wanted to put in different places on the site, and that reception hall was there on the design. Just a little sheet of A4 with black lines and little red boxes where we wanted to put the buildings. And then all these years later, seeing so many of those buildings have come into being, and that the reception hall is on the way. And that sense of ongoing development and healthy growth is naturally very delightful to see. And so many people who were there on that those original times, like Fred and Debbie and some others. I can't see all the faces in the dimness, but many of the people who were involved so far back then, Dee Cuthbert, Jeannie Bendick, and others who helped to get the house cleaned up on day one when we all moved in, still very much involved. It's also coming to somebody else's Katina festival day. It's really delightful to not have to be doing anything. So that's a great treat. The organization for this, all the many months of preparation, of figuring out the arrangements, how everything is going to work, printing the leaflets and arranging all the tasks. I don't have to be involved in any of it. Earlier this year, when I was leading a retreat at Amravati, one of the people on the retreat who's from Polish ancestry, he said, in Poland there's an expression, not my circus, not my monkeys. And I thought this is an extremely profound piece of folklore. Not my circus, not my monkeys. So this can mean a variety of things. But what it's intended to mean, as my friend was explaining, was it's something that we don't have to get worried about. The mind tends to get involved and gets can get fretful about things, worldly issues and worldly concerns. But there are many things in life where we don't really need to be involved. We don't need to get wrapped up. And so you could take that piece of folklore as saying, it's your problem, mate. It has nothing to do with me. You know, I'm out of here. So that can be, you know, one aspect of it. But also, when he was speaking about it, the theme was the issue of how we get wrapped up in each other's concerns and anxieties, and we make other people's problems our own and then carry them around and inflate them, and how we don't have to do that. We can, say, remind ourselves, this is not my circus. This is not my issue. I don't have to be wrapped up in this. I don't have to jump on this particular bandwagon. And these are not my monkeys. Yeah, you know, monkeys are mischievous creatures that like to jump around and cause lots of monkeyish things. We call it causing chaos from the human side, from the monkey's side. I'm sure they're just doing their natural thing. But that, I feel, is a very useful aphorism, a useful saying to remind ourselves that, you know, when it's, say, looking at the things of the world around us, to remind us, this is not my circus. I don't have to be involved. I don't have to pick this up. These are not my monkeys. They're just monkeys. And as he was speaking about this, because I was using a quoting Ajahn Chah's teaching about monkeys, where he was saying, if you have a monkey and you expect it to sort of sit still and be quiet, you're expecting the wrong thing, because monkeys don't do that. Monkeys naturally jump around and they're busy and active. And he was using the example in terms of relating to the mind. He said the mind is like a monkey. It's natural to be creating thoughts. It's natural for it to be dodging from one subject to another. Like, as the Buddha described it, the mind jumps from one thing to another, like the monkeys jumping through the branches of a tree. So Lompo Cha was pointing to the fact that that's what monkeys do. That's what the mind does. If you expect the mind to be different, then you create a problem. But if you recognize that's the nature of mind, that's what it does naturally, then you can be at peace. It's still a monkey, but you can be at peace with it. You're not trying to find peace by anesthetizing the monkey, or getting rid of it. But you're learning that that's the nature of the way monkeys are. That's the way the mind is. So that whether there are thoughts or not, or feelings, emotions, that you don't have to contend against them. You don't have to fight with them. You can recognize, well, that's just the way that thoughts are. This is just the way emotions are. They go up, they go down, they jump around all over the place. That's their nature. That's their habit. Or when we relate to our mind and the activities of the world in a similar way, we apply that kind of attitude, then we are in a sense becoming at peace with the way monkeys are. You say, you're not my circus, not my monkeys. You're not saying all monkeys are evil and that the circus of the world should stop, but it's a sense of letting it be as it is, a sense of disentanglement, a sense of non-attachment, non-identification. When we relate to the things around us in that way, it's not a sort of dismissive rejection, but it's a relaxing of our grip, a relaxing of identification, not getting stressed and concerned and upset about the things of the world around us, the emotions of the people around us, the people that we live with, the people that we work with. Similarly, it also applies within us, that we can usefully apply this same principle to, just as Ajahn Chah was encouraging, to the activities of our own mind, because it's not just other people's emotions around us or the activities, the ups and downs of the world outside us, but also inside us, that we don't have to have that sense of ownership or a sense of identification with our own thoughts, our own emotions, the ups and downs of our own mind. Or when we try to train our mind, so we take up the practices of concentration, trying to bring the mind to a single point, learning to concentrate the mind using mindfulness of breathing or walking meditation or many different kinds of trainings in samatha, concentration. When we try to develop insight, vipassana, or all the different ways that the Buddha and our teachers encourage us to relate to letting go of selfishness, letting go of anger and fear, lust and jealousy and so forth, all the afflictive emotions and negative emotional habits that we have. We can put a great deal of effort. We can put tremendous energy and effort into fulfilling those intentions. You know, people come here for a Saturday evening Dhamma talk. People come and stay in the monastery. People come to train as Anagarikas, Samaniras, Bhikkhus, lay residents living here, and people coming as guests, coming on retreats. We can put in hours, weeks, months, years of effort into training the mind, developing these particular skills, and learning to work with different obstructions and to transform those hindrances into the factors of enlightenment. And these are all standard aspects of training and very important to us. But what we find is that we can put huge amounts of effort and energy into those practices, but still reap a lot of frustration and disappointment. That can seem sometimes that no matter how hard we work, no matter the amount of effort that we put in, we're still not being fulfilled, or we're still being disappointed. Our practice isn't bearing the kind of fruit that we wish for. One of the phrases that I reflect upon a lot of Lumpo Sumedho's teachings is that this five-volume collection of Ajahn Sumedho's teachings, Ajahn Sajito and I helped to edit that, so we gathered all the material, figured out the order to put it all in. Ajahn Sajito did all the kind of editing of it, and before it was printed, I read the whole thing through from page one of volume one to page 315 of volume five, to proofread the entire thing. So I got very, very well acquainted with Ajahn Sumedho's teachings, or reacquainted intimately, in great detail. And so over the winter retreat, I spent many, many, many hours. And one of the themes that he addresses over and over and over again is to say, if you are doing something now to achieve something in the future, then you're missing the point. That is a great error in Dhamma practice. The effort to practice a Dhamma is, if you're doing something now in order to become enlightened in the future, then inevitably you're missing the mark. Because in that way, you're basing your practice upon self-view. There's me here now who is incomplete and imperfect, and I've got to do something to me now so that off in the future there'll be a me who's perfect. There's a me who's got defilements now and who hasn't developed the factors of enlightenment, and if I get rid of the defilements, get the factors of enlightenment, then there'll be an enlightened me somewhere over there. Well, this is practicing the Dhamma based on self-view. On the view of an independent, separate me here at this time, and looking forward to being a different me somewhere off in the future. And over and over again, he makes this point from the earliest times right there through until his later teachings, that is. And there are many of you who've been on retreats with him, maybe back from the 70s, 80s, early 90s, can hear his voice saying the same thing. Doing something now in order to become enlightened in the future is missing the point. But the point is instead to be enlightened now, to be awake now. The Dhamma is here and now. And that being awake can mean being awake to erratic emotions can be awake, being awake to the chattering mind, the monkey jumping through the branches and knowing, oh, that's look at it go. Look what the mind is doing now. But being awake to the mind being dull, awake to the mind being jealous, awake to the mind being peaceful, awake to the mind being agitated, awake to the mind being enraged, that very wakefulness here and now, you know, this is how we practice Dhamma. And so you can say that's practicing Dhamma based on right view rather than based on self view. I find this is an incredibly important teaching because the habits of self-view are so strong. It's like, yes, but I am imperfect. You know, I have got lots of defilements. I do need to get rid of them. And I do need to develop all these other good qualities. Look, it says here in the book, like look here, Arjuna, it says in the sutta, it tells me, you know, get rid of this and develop that. Right? That's what I'm supposed to be doing. And so we can feel like we're following the formula, we're following the instructions. But what is being missed is that there's me coming into the picture. That's the kind of self-view factor sneaks in the back door. You know, climbs up the pathway up the back of the mountain, comes in through the little paths over the back end of the property, and sneaks in and takes over, and we don't even realize it. That it's me who's got this set of problems, me who needs to develop these good qualities, me who's practicing, me who's trying to do the right thing, me who's trying to understand this Dhamma talk. It's insidious. It slides in and takes over. So then, so much of the practice then, and Lumpo Pasano is very fond of this particular aspect of the teaching, practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. Dhamma nu Dhamma Patipada. I'm sure you still talk about that these days.
Last month.
There you go. This was not a setup. I didn't know that. But so practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, rather than practicing Dhamma in accordance with self-view. You practice Dhamma in accordance with self-view, then it's not going to take you to a helpful place. It's always going to cause more alienation and confusion. Practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma means learning how to apply effort without that effort being caught up with self-view, without the eye-making and mind-making habits. This is maybe a subtle area of practice, but I feel it's really, really important because we can enter this whole thing with great sincerity. We apply ourselves with great commitment and, yes, this is meaningful, this is the most important thing. And then we have faith and we have energy, but without this wisdom factor and recognizing the importance of that, then all that faith and energy can go very diligently down the wrong track. You're like coming out onto Tomkai Road and going right instead of left. That'll take you up into the netherworld of the hills between us and Willits and a long and winding dirt road that wanders through the hills. Maybe you'll get you to Willits, maybe not. But the other road sort of takes you to the nice open highway. Or one of the ways I like to explore and to describe this this area is to recognize that this path requires effort. The Buddha pointed out this. His teaching was a teaching of the application of effort. It's not a teaching of passivity. So peacefulness doesn't mean passivity. It doesn't mean not doing or disengaging, because if you think, well, if I'm not supposed to make, if there's the practice is supposed to be done without me, if it's just waking up, then am I not supposed to do anything, just sort of kind of be here but not be me? You know, how do I do that? Is it like just kind of switching off and not doing? And so it can be misunderstood that if we talk in these ways that it's a promotion of a kind of passive attitude or a switching off or a kind of spiritual numbing. But that's not what the Buddha's teaching is pointing to at all. It's a teaching of effort. The application of effort and energy is so many of the lists of the wholesome qualities, like the energy, virya is there in the five spiritual faculties, the spiritual powers. It's there in the list of factors of enlightenment in the 10 paramitas. Right effort, samavayamo, is there in the Eightfold Path. So, you know, energy and effort is very much a part of the practice. But the skill is applying effort without the sense of self, without a self-view being brought into it. So that when the instructions tell us, yes, if you see the unwholesome, if the unwholesome arises, then it should be abandoned, or the unwholesome should be restrained from arising in the first place, if possible. You should the practice, the right effort is based upon giving rise to the wholesome, and if the wholesome has arisen, then to maintain it in being. These are the qualities of right effort. But all of that can be done and is encouraged to be done without there being a sense of self brought into that. That there is the wisdom mind, the wisdom faculty, the panya chaku, the eye of wisdom, can notice that the unwholesome has arisen. There's a feeling of fear or aversion, negativity, as a feeling of jealousy or greed. That can be recognized and then restrained. And that recognition and that restraint can be applied without the habits of self-centered thinking saying, oh, I'm feeling angry, I'm jealous, I've got to stop that jealousy, I've got to get rid of that fear, I'm an angry person, I've got to get rid of this anger. That I and me and mine is all extra. That's all, you know, added on through the habits of self-view and the unconscious clinging and identification that goes on. If we apply the practice in a skillful way, then there's the mindfulness of a feeling of aversion, a mindfulness of a feeling of greed or fear, and then the recognition this is unwholesome, this is unskillful, unhelpful, and the effort to restrain that, to let, if it's arisen, to let go of it, or to restrain it from arising in the first place. Similarly, the effort to cultivate the wholesome, to give rise to loving kindness, to compassion, the effort to focus the mind on a wholesome object, like I say in concentration practice. That effort, rather than, oh, I've got to get concentrated, I need to let go of my distracted thoughts, you know, I've got to have more loving kindness, I'm a bit narrow-minded and self-centered, I need to be more compassionate. All that I, me, should, all that is extra, but the recognition that loving kindness is wholesome, compassion is wholesome, concentration is wholesome, wisdom is wholesome, these can be recognized and also brought into being without any sense of self being involved whatsoever. So I like to bring this point up, as I was saying, because it makes such a huge difference. It's rather like driving carefully and mindfully in the right direction rather than driving carefully and mindfully in the wrong direction. We can be ever so careful in our driving, but we've taken a wrong turn and we're carefully driving hundreds of miles out of our way. When we practice based upon right view, then that effort then brings forth very, very beautiful and liberating results. If the practice is based upon self-view, then it's always going to bring and feed that sense of alienation, that sense of me as an independent, separate entity existing in this particular time, this particular place. And so its result is always depressing. As Ajahn Sumedho famously stated, and is often quoted as saying, whenever I think about myself, I feel depressed. And he shouldn't mean that. He's got a particularly depressing personality, but just intrinsic in the mix. As soon as we think the word I, we take that as a solid reality, it's depressing. That there's a confining, there's an alienation, there's a kind of an aloneness and a vulnerability that is right there in that I feeling. But at the opposite end of the scale, as soon as that I is seen as transparent, as empty, as a formation, a mental formation that is void of substance, then that there is no depression. That quality of limitation and vulnerability that automatically dissipates. And one of the difficulties is that these two different approaches, they look very like each other. You know, the one, me trying to become concentrated, me trying to get rid of my defilements, me trying to be a good Buddhist, me trying to be a good Anagarika, novice, samanera, layperson, upasaka, upasika. They can look very, very like each other. One is based on, one is based on wisdom and one is based on ignorance, but they look very like each other. And the comparison I always make is like the right and the left hand. They look exactly like each other, but they're also exactly opposite. And so, on the one hand, you have samavayamo, right effort, which is the cure, and it can look very, very like the michavayamo, or wrong effort, or what we can call the desire to become bhava tanha, the desire to become that. Practicing based upon tanha, upon craving, upon identification, that it looks very, very similar, but it's also the opposite. That's the cause of the ailment, the cause of dukkha. If we recognize that this is a particular sort of issue of practice, we see that this is a habit, then we can become alert to it. We can say bring our attention to that self-creating mind, the I-making and mind-making habit. If we know that's a symptom of the of the problem, then that's what to look out for. It's like, if I'm sure we've got a few medical people here in the hall. You look for the symptoms, you look for the signs that tell you, aha, there's an imbalance in the system. This is what the symptoms are, and this is what they're pointing to. So that if you notice the mind is thinking in terms of, I've got problems, I've got to get more of this, I've got to get rid of that, I need to... That I, me and mine, that's the symptom, that's the clue that there is practice being enacted based on self-view and based on bhava-tanha, the desire to become. So that's the clue. So then bringing attention, following that symptom, okay, then we need to address that. And so then... the various practices that we can apply to help illuminate, clarify that self-creating habit. Because you can't just, look at that, I recognize this, I hear what he's saying, this sounds perfectly reasonable, right, I'll stop, I'll stop thinking in terms of self-view. You can't just send out an order from mission control, from the management, and then you get immediate compliance down in the on the shop floor. It doesn't, at least my experience is, it doesn't work that way. But we have instead to be attentive and apply a mindful awareness moment by moment, and seeing those habits taking shape. You can't just sort of decide once and make it happen forever, but it's a more of an ongoing moment by moment application. So when we watch the mind and look at its way of forming and phrasing things, one of the most helpful ways of letting go of those self-creating habits is to highlight them. Like if you see that the mind saying, I need to be more concentrated, but I'm not, I'm not enlightened yet. And I do need more concentration. Yeah. And I have got lots of defilements. Just to catch the mind saying that, say, I need more concentration. That's what I need. So you catch the thought, I've got lots of defilements. I am the owner of all these defilements. They are mine. They belong to me. They are what I am. I am the owner. These are mine. Mine. So you take that thought and you highlight it. So often the influences of identification and ownership, they have power because they're sort of off at the edges, just out of vision. But if you get them front center and say, talk to me, you know, and get them to speak up, if you highlight them, say, I've got a lot of problems. I need to get rid of my problems. And once I've got rid of my problems, there'll be me without problems, and that will be great. And if you spell it out like that, you know, slowly and clearly, if you do it out loud, then, well, people will think you're talking on your phone, but but do it internally, just say, I've got a lot of problems. If I get rid of my problems, then there'll be me without problems, and won't that be fine? Then as we you catch that and state that, make that a clear sort of internal declaration, what I find is that you can't get to the end of the sentence before it falls apart. It starts to sound ridiculous. You know, our wisdom, in a way, employing the wisdom faculty to see and to look, say, oh, that knows that's not the whole story, or that's the mind is making a lot of presumptions. And so that claiming, that feeling of ownership and I making, it falls apart under the light of wisdom. It just sort of wilts. California, lots of hot sunshine these days. Wilting comes very easily here. So like putting out a young plant out in the full glare of the sun, it wilts. You know, the sun scorches it. In the same way, the bright sun of wisdom will cause those habits of self-view to wilt. So that just using this way of taking those attitudes, those self-creating patterns, and to bring them under the light of wisdom, then they wilt. They fall apart. They can't stand up. They're not safely in the shade. Yeah. Another way of working with these that these kind of attitudes, Lumpur Cha suggested a couple of methods, ways of reflection. And one of his great skills, Lumpur Cha had an immense ability to use the reflective mind, the wisdom faculty, to explore and investigate the attitudes that we have and the patterns of thinking that we carry around and go along with. And he would suggest that developing the insight into anicca, into uncertainty or impermanence, and so it takes a lot. It takes a bit of attention, a lot of care to watch the mind and its flow of thoughts in this way. But if we are attentive, then as you find the mind making a statement like "That's awful," or "I don't like that," or "That's great, I want more of that," or "I need to be like this," or "I shouldn't be like that," then he would encourage us to just reflect, you know, is that so? Is that true? Is that a true thing? Like when the mind says, that's awful, just ask yourself, is that so? Or your mind praises something, oh, that's great, he's wonderful, he's really inspiring, he's a marvelous person, is that so? Or he's a terrible person, she's awful, I can't stand her. You know, she shouldn't be that way, is that so? We talk about ourselves, you know, I'm really proud of, this is a really good aspect of who I am. Well, is that so? Or might be, oh, that's really, I've got this really awful problem, this is really terrible, this is an incurable fault. Oh, is that so? I've got to get more of this, is that so? I've got to get rid of that, is that so? That we, by applying that sort of reflection upon uncertainty, then we are bringing our judgments into perspective. And when we genuinely ask that kind of a question, then if you apply it, it's not a big effort, but it's a careful effort, rather like putting a key into a lock. If it's the right key, it's not a huge effort. It's not like a lot of muscular effort to put the key in the lock and turn it, but just that small amount of the right effort opens the door and you can get through it. If you haven't got the right key and you don't put it in the lock, you can't get through the door. So this kind of application of wise reflection and examining our assumptions about what I like, what I don't like, what I call good, what I call bad, what I call mine, what I call yours, that simple way of shining a light on it, it's not a big effort, but it's a precise effort. But if we apply it, just like putting the key in, the right key in the lock and opening the door, then it can make life very, very easy for us. Like, I mean, nowadays you don't need keys for cars. You just when you used to have to put the key in the lock of your car, and if you forgot your keys, then it was a problem. I mean, it still happens now. But if your keys are locked inside your car, or you have forgotten your keys, you can't get in the car. Yeah, it's not accessible. And you just need, well, where have I put my keys? I just need the key. If I could just get in, then I could drive away, but I can't. Where are my keys? Are they in the car? Where did I leave them? All you need is that little key, and then once it's in the right lock, then you can get in the car and you can drive. If you haven't got the key or it's locked in the car, then you're in, as we say in England, in deep shtuck. He's in trouble. So this is a very simple practice, and you might hear it in the Dhamma talk and say, oh yeah, right, great, fantastic, and then park it on the shelf and leave it. But it's one of these practices that if you apply it, it has extraordinary strength. It has a really a great ability to change the habits of thinking and to break up the patterns of self-view that we tend to create. And if you want an even simpler version, which works in a similar way, just say the word "so," like, "Oh, this is great." So, "Oh, this is awful." So, like, "Oh, this is fine. My practice is really falling apart. This is a disaster." So, "Oh, this is great. Things are really going well. At last, my samadhi's come together." So. And that claiming of the mind, that approving, disapproving, liking, disliking, it continually puts that into perspective. And it's incredibly simple. One word. And if you apply it, like putting the key into the lock and getting into the car, then it makes all the difference in the world. So that these are some simple methods, just easy ways, well, easy, simple ways that we can, say, break up the habits of self-view, and then in that way help to practice Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, practicing Dhamma in accordance with right view rather than self-view. And that when we do that, then we see the results for ourselves, and they're very beautiful, very very glorious, like these fantastic flower arrangements that Apple and the team, the gang, the sort of transforming Abhayagiri into Nimana, the Nimanarati Devaloka. Apparently each year Apple has been sort of upgrading the degree of celestial refinement. So like last year we had the Yama Devas, and then Tusita Devas last year, and this year the next level up is the Nimanarati Devas. So Nimanarati Devaloka is the Devas who delight in creating. And so I don't know what she's going to do next year, because the Paranimitta Vasavati Devaloka is those who delight in the creations of others. So maybe Apple will just bring the flowers and tell the gang, get on with it, and I'll see what you do. But that's not a suggestion. It's just I'm just wondering how that might work out. But so these glorious flowers and the kind of dripping diamonds and wonderful jewels sparkling amongst them. Yeah, that this.
These prayers are Dhammacakka.
And the plate is the Dhammacakka in the center. So these are ways of symbolizing that. The beauty of the heart when it's freed from ignorance. These are glorious flower arrangements, but they are external expressions of the inner beauty that we can wake up to, that we can realize when the heart is freed from its limitations, from its confusions. So we have a long day, a big day tomorrow, and so I could probably sit here and talk all night, but out of compassion for everyone, I will put a cap on it and offer these words for consideration this evening. Namaste.